Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Mike Smith, third-generation firefighter with 19 years of career experience, a captain with Shawnee Fire Department in Ohio. Mike believes that you can teach the skill set when it comes to the mechanics of being a firefighter, but you can't teach passion to go with it. That must come within the individual. At the workplace, not everyone is passionate, so it's extremely important for organizations and leaders to identify and differentiate their passionate employees as they are pivotal to success. With that, I present Mr. Mike Smith.
My name is Michael Smith. Been in the fire service full-time for about 19 years. Prior to that, I did some high school work. Basically, it was a program that high school set up to where half the day we could go to our job shadow place. And at the time, the fire department in the high school did not have a program in place. So I was instrumental in trying to get that going, and it got set up through me. And then there, from what I understand, there's been a few people after me who've done the same thing.
Okay. So the fire service was never really on your radar per se, like you have no other family members in it or anything of that nature.
I'm actually third generation fireman. My grandfather and my father were both volunteer. So not full-time. My father was like a full-time police officer for a little bit. And so that kind of gave me the whole idea when I was real small of, you know, maybe that's what I want to do. And it just kind of grew into it, and it never left, and ended up doing it from day one.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned that, you know, you kind of got into like a vocational program through high school that got you into the fire service. So upon completing that, how did you come about trying to find an organization to go work for?
Okay. Yeah. So when I went to high school, it was about 2002, was my senior year. And it was quite a long time ago now, but at the time, getting in the fire service in Ohio was extremely difficult. A lot of people going out for not a whole lot of positions. Looking through that program, this is what they called young professionals at the time, gave me half days at school, and then I was able to leave and go to my place of choice. Basically, everybody get to choose where they wanted to go. I chose the fire department. So part of that was of my day was going in, hanging out with the fire chief of the department that my school was at. So through that communication, sit through him, talking with him and learning from that fire chief, eventually the second semester came around and you're supposed to change careers. And I told him I didn't want to change careers. This is what I wanted to do. And so they said, okay, you could stay. And the chief decided that since I did the first one with him, he's like, the second one you do with firemen, because that's where you're going to be anyway. So I spent a lot of time with the firemen. They let me come back, let me do 24s if I wanted to stay with them the whole time, and ended up getting with a shift that I really liked and gelled with. And they basically mentored me through the whole process.
Okay. All right. Awesome. And that's no better way to get the experience than to do just that.
Yeah, it was an excellent experience to get. The people that I kind of gelled with were just fantastic mentors, very good aggressive firemen. It was just, you know, and it was, you know, a lot of strong leaders in that group. And it was something I really thrived with. It worked out really well for us.
Okay. And so how did you land upon Shawnee?
So, like I said, it was very difficult to find a job. I was going through my training after school, went to Columbus, got my fire, got my medic, my EMT, all that stuff was done. And I was just trying to find a job somewhere as a fireman. I was working private ambulance in Columbus, and that was, it is for some people. And mm-hmm. It's definitely not for me. I tried it as long as I could. It was a good job that really gets you started, help you kind of build patient rapport and stuff. So that was nice, but I just couldn't do it forever. So kept looking for a new opportunity. And my wife and I were going to get married and go to for our honeymoon down to South Carolina. So in this place, once we came back, I thought, hey, I wonder if they have a fire department. Sure enough, they did. They were hiring. We went back down there. I applied, interviewed, took the agility test, and they hired me all on the same day. So it was a fantastic time down in South Carolina. We spent 2 years down there. We had our first child and decided we probably should move back to Ohio to be with the family. And my daughter can know the grandparents and the whole family back in Ohio. So we moved back to Ohio, went back to private ambulance. And again, it was still difficult to find a job, but it was starting to ease up a little bit. I went back to the chief that I was riding with from my high school town, and he's like, "Hey, this place is hiring. You should give it a chance. They're actually they take care of their guys. There's a guy from here who went up there a long time ago." So I did. I applied up there, took the test, and next thing you know, that's where I've been for the past 17 years.
17 years. Okay. All right. And I'm assuming going from one department and leaving to go back home, everyone has various reasons, but was that a difficult decision, especially like kind of not really starting over, but in a sense, you're starting over because you're going from one department to another?
Yeah, it was very difficult for me. I didn't want to leave. I was completely content with everything down there. The fire department, the shift that I was on, it was a very heavy training shift. So I started, when you start your career off in a way that kind of sets your future. You start off in a lackadaisical shift. Well, likely your future doesn't really look very promising. But if you start off in a real aggressive shift, who likes to train, likes to learn, likes to teach. It is helpful for you. So they were fantastic. Probably if you really look at the grand scheme of it, maybe trained a little too much. Even on Sundays we're out there drilling and stuff, which it's good, it's good. But some people could say it's a little too much sometimes. And it's the beach, so when you're down there, it's hot, and we're all geared up and doing training in the middle of the day. It was fun. It was a good experience for a young kid like myself. My wife was determined to move back to Ohio, and I guess it's like, well, I said, we'll put our house for sale. Thinking, oh, it's going to take a while to sell our house. It's sold in 2 days. It's like, oh man. So I guess we're doing this, and we ended up moving back to Ohio, and but we moved back by the time I got back. So my wife went first with our first daughter. And she moved some of the stuff. I moved the rest of it. I didn't get back till about February. And I started at my current job in June. So it was a short period of time, but it was long enough.
Right. Okay. And for those that don't know, including myself, can you tell us about your department, the size, amount of personnel, stations, things of that nature?
Yeah. Current department or the previous one?
Current. Sorry, current.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so current department, it's a smaller department, rural area. It's more of a suburban when it comes to how we're located. We're on the edge of a larger city. We have about 13,000, we'll say roughly, people as a population of our area, our district. But we are heavy industry, very heavy industry. Petrochemical, we have a lot of chemicals. So a lot of that, and then the area is it's a they like to think of it as a little more ritzier area. So it's a little expensive house, bigger houses, especially the nice area compared to the city that we're adjoined to.
Okay. And
We have one station. We
okay.
run we have 21 guys total, seven a shift, and one prevention person, one chief. And that's pretty much it for the department itself, one administrative assistant. And so we run three shifts. We run it's a stranger schedule type, more of a California swing. So you work 24, you're off 24, work 24, off 24, work 24, and then you're off 4 days straight.
Okay.
So we have three shifts that rotate that.
Okay. So what you guys call a California schedule, to me that sounds, you said 24 on, 24 off. Okay, no, it's not the same schedule that I was thinking, but similar. So you work 324 Four, three 24s on and then off, and then you have four off.
Correct.
Okay. All right. And the amount of personnel on, do you have just an engine strictly? Is it engine-based department, or do you have a mix?
We have it all. We have the tanker, we have the ladder, we have rescue, we have three medics, two engines, a grass truck, and a command vehicle. So it's crazy when what actually goes out on the first line assignment is usually just like our engine and bladder, engine tanker, depends on where it's at, or engine, depends on the access. Sometimes we have difficulty getting access to places. We might have to take two engines on the same call, but we rely a lot on mutual aid. I'm trying to keep up with NFPA and getting the 14 on the first alarm assignment. So we pull a lot of our full-time departments that are around us to come with mutual aid on our first assignment.
Okay. And what's your minimum staffing across the board?
Our minimum is six a shift. So we
Six
have
shift.
seven a shift and minimum six. So one person could be off without overtime. The second person creates overtime, which creates a lot of overtime.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So before I get to that, all right. So you said six a shift, right? Or seven?
Six. Seven
Seven.
a shift is full staff.
Okay, I'm assuming a battalion chief or no?
Yes, one battalion chief, one captain, and five firemen.
Okay, so if you get a, let's just say a medical call, how many are going on the engine and how many are going on? Because I believe you said you had like an ambulance, a rescue type unit.
Yeah, we have three ambulances. That pretty much is our workload, is the ambulance. Two go on the ambulance, two firemen. And it depends on the call. If it's an ALS call, depends on the ALS. Like, I'm not talking IV or something like that, but let's say it's chest pain. Chest pain is something that could be anything. Then the battalion and the captain will take the command vehicle to follow the medic. So if it's for some reason, big trauma or something like that, they need an extra hand. The captain's the person that will jump over and help the medic and run with the medic into the hospital.
Okay, so the captain doesn't stay on the apparatus per se.
Correct. I
Okay.
float between my truck, the medic. I go to the ladder. Like, if we're going mutual aid, it's always the captain going out. So I'll be on the ladder, I'll be on the tanker. You got to know them all.
Okay, but are you operating it, or are you riding the seat on these apparatuses?
Yeah, I will be basically in charge of our crew.
Okay.
So yeah, I won't necessarily be running the truck unless it can happen. Sometimes it just depends on the captain. You know, myself, I'd much rather do the work rather than sit back and watch. So I'll take the people and we'll go and do the work. So.
Okay. All right. So, like, okay, I get it. I get it now. So if you leave, let's say you leave with your battalion chief to go on this advanced ALS run, and another first due call comes in that's not like first responder related, then your firefighter, or I guess your senior most firefighter, will be riding the seat and riding in charge.
It can work like that, because sometimes that senior fireman could be on the medic. The way I do my rotations is that I try to rotate everybody off the medic, so at least one time. And our junior people, they have to be on it at least twice, just because we don't have enough people to do it once. So basically, that senior person has picked. I give him choice. You know, what day of the tour do you want? And he's like, I'll take first. So he's first day in, he's on the medic. Second day in, my second senior person chose the medic, so he'll be on the medic at that point, and then the third just gets split up between the three junior people.
Okay. Wow. All right. And so the way you're describing it, I call it like musical fire trucks. Like
Yes.
you can never really set your gear per se, because you're depending on the call, you're going to be going on a different apparatus. So that is a lot.
It is. And you know, it's like there's good and bad to it. It depends on the style of person, right? Like, you go to a bigger city, you're specialized in one vehicle and that's all you have to do. Well, smaller city, you're learning them all, and you have to know them all. And it's a lot more to know, a little more taxing on you, because there is no set plan ever. you just have to go with it, go with the flow every time.
Okay. And as far as if a first due structural box comes in, what is Shawnee dropping on the first alarm assignment?
Okay. So first alarm assignment, depending if it's commercial or residential.
To make it easy, let's say residential.
Okay. Residential. And again, it depends on where we're going because we have some really big neighborhoods. Let's say it's a big neighborhood. I'm on the engine. I got a 3-man engine, sometimes four if we're at seven, right? And then it either a 2-man or a 3-man ladder, depends on our staffing level.
Okay. And then your
And our,
battalion chief, of course.
command car. He'll be in the command car.
And then as far as your mutual aid, are you getting two departments or three departments?
Usually first assignment's usually two, unless it's so what we call a working fire, like everybody else. We get there, arrive on scene, notice that it is a working fire. We make that working fire assignment, and it goes into a automatic two and a medic from one of them as well. So we'll get two engines and a medic on the working fire assignment. If it's a really big, let's say it's fully involved and we're calling for second alarm, we're going to get even more from there. So we'll start looking into more of the volunteer mutual aids at that point.
Okay. And how far are you mutual aid coming? Like 10 minutes, 5 minutes?
Yeah, it's so it depends on where it's at in our district. We cover 29 miles.
Okay.
So if we're on the west side, it can be our closest full-time department, usually about within 10 minutes, they can be there. East side, they can be there within about 5, 7 minutes. And then south side's volunteer. So we're calling, we'll still call our full-timers in. It's a little more of a drive for them. But, volunteer, they still have to get to the scene or get to their station, get their gear, and show up. So sometimes it's really good. Sometimes it's not. And you just kind of have to wait and hope that they show up.
Right. Okay. And then it sounds like you definitely have a mix. You said you have a heavy commercial industry in your first due, larger homes, and I'm assuming with a tanker, you might have some areas where rural water is needed, right?
Yep, absolutely. We have, I think, so I just did our AFG grant. I think we're at about 85 to 87% of our district is covered by hydrants. So we're getting better. It's just so we don't run our water department. We rely on our city. And for them reaching out into some of our more rural areas, they're not going to get into the money. So they don't really like to extend that out as well, it seems like. So getting all the way 100% is not likely ever going to happen for us, but it makes it a little more challenging with our tanker situation. The goal right now is to reduce our footprint and kind of combine trucks. The previous administrations that we had did not like to combine trucks, and so we had a heavy rescue at one point, and putting people in the rescue and then people on the engine because you're going to an MVA, so it takes a lot of people. And then a lot of trucks, and now it seems like it's one, two guys per truck, which isn't always the best plan. So now we're starting to combine. We're getting the engine pumper or the rescue pumpers. We're getting the tanker pumpers and starting to put trucks together so we don't need as many out at the same time.
Okay. And I'm assuming just me listening to you, I'm going to assume your truck is probably not a dry truck. It's probably a Quint.
Yeah, it has 400 gallons, just basically enough to wet the mainstream narrow that way. When the aerial, once it's up, we have enough to get it started, but it's not gonna last. You have to have a main supply somewhere.
Okay. All right. With that being said, are there any talks maybe of a second station to help reduce, the call volume ish?
Hey. So that's a tough question. We did pass a levy to build a second station. Once we started digging into what it would cost, what it's going to do, what you're going to have to do with staffing, it didn't seem like there was much belief in that progress. So then it was like talk of let's just redo our station. Our station was built in 58. It's just non-conducive to the fire service of today. And so that's even been a struggle trying to get that going with how inflation's kind of gone and now all expenses have just kind of shot through the roof. It's been an interesting ride on this process of trying to figure out what direction we're going to go with our levy. But they're still spending it, they're saving it, putting it into a capital improvement fund, so it's appropriated for those purchases. But it's still kind of the process of where and what are we building, where are we going to build it, how are we going to build it, and when. It's definitely the question.
Okay. All right. With that being said, upon entering, upon like your first couple of years with Shawnee, did you try to find those like-minded people like you had in South Carolina, guys that were into the job that wanted to train, wanted to get better at the profession?
So it all depends on the person. It seems like you can't teach passion to guys. You can't,
Right.
you just can't. Some people have it and some don't. You see a lot of, when I first came in, there's a lot of older guys and then younger guys. So it was a very big divide between the two. I'm not saying personality wise, I'm just saying just in age and years of service. So most of the older guys were more, looking toward the end of their career while the young guys are looking to learn and build up. So there wasn't a whole lot of progress that way. Getting to the point now where we're starting to see a lot more medium range guys, because all of us who just started out then are now in that middle spot. So you see the new people coming in, and some of them just don't have passion that that others did. And you really kind of see a little bit of the skill drop on some of that when that happens, because you can't teach patching. I can teach the guys the job, I can teach them whatever they want to learn, but at some point, if you don't have passion, you're not really going to look forward to going out and trying to get training, look forward to going out and learning on your own. It's just more of, I'll just take what you feed me and that's it.
Right.
Which makes it a lot more difficult. But in our department, we just have a mix of it. There are a handful of passionate people who try to push progress and change and getting better. And then there's a lot who just, kind of would much rather stick in their ways and don't want to move too much.
Yeah, it's a daily struggle, trust me. I know.
Yeah.
I hear you 100 loud and clear, loud and clear. I mean, you can teach anybody anything regarding skill. But you can't teach, like you said, you can't teach someone to love the job. And I understand, like, not everybody's gonna like it or love it the way you do, but if you don't have just a little bit of that love in you, then to me, you'll always just be the bare minimum standard mediocre firefighter who hits the checklist, he or she hits the checklist or benchmark, and that's as far as it's gonna go.
Yeah, and for me as an officer, you always see people come in, and then those people who want to wait for trainings to come to them. Like, for instance, the chief gets an email and says, I need to fill this class, and help me find three people. And then him going to somebody and saying, hey, you want to take this class? You want to take this class? That to me doesn't look good. That's somebody who's sitting back waiting for the class. The people who are actively looking and searching for classes to take, looking and searching to get better, to get smarter, to know more of the new things that are coming out, new techniques, new progress of the departments and the fire service in general. Those are the ones that look good, does have the initiative to look into that kind of stuff, not wait for it to come to them.
Definitely. So at what point in your career did you decide, like, hey, I want to go up for a company officer, or do you have to go through steps, or are you allowed to skip, certain positions?
Yeah, so I've always been the type that I'm a free thinker. No matter what I go on, but even when I was younger. So at first, it's absorb it all in, right? You're a sponge. You take it all in. You learn from watching everybody. But you have to learn. You can't ever take anything as, oh, well, we do that because they did it that way. And it's like, no, why did they do it that way? Learn why. What's going on? What do they know that you don't? So I've always been one of them types that I want, okay, well, hey, why'd you do that? Ask, learn, figure it out. Sometimes it doesn't go well, but you still got to learn from it, right? Sometimes it's great, and it's like, hey, this worked last time. This is something put in the box. That way we can pull it out if we ever need it. But yeah, just learning the process, learning how everybody's working, moving towards directions of bettering myself. So then I find myself, 5 years, 6 years in, and I'm going, hey, we're on this fire. Why are we doing it this way? I'm not questioning out loud and questioning what my job is or anything, but in my head, I'm thinking, why are we doing it this way? There's a better way of doing this. We can do it this way, and we wouldn't be here anymore. We get in Ohio, we have all seasons, right? So it's not just warm all the time, it's not cold all the time. But cold fires are never fun. They are, you go out, you get to work, right? You're sweating, and then you're done, and you're doing overhaul or something, and you just start freezing. Your gear is freezing, and everything is cold and miserable. So for me, I'm like, let's get off the scene as quick as we can. Let's get back. It's warmer back at the station. So getting the job done the best way possible, most efficient way possible, it's always been a process of mine. So taking that into my leadership role was like, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to lead these guys. I want to be able to teach. I want to be able to be efficient and make my crew efficient and do everything the best we can and quick as we can, the safest way, of course. But that way everybody's learning, everybody's getting better, and they're going to be better at what they're doing.
So, did you go from, firefighter for a couple of years straight to captain, or were you able to like, or does Sean, you do like engineer, lieutenant, and then captain?
So the first department I started at, they had it a lot more spread out. We had three departments with 17 guys a shift, so it was a big department. So you start off as probationary, and then when you're done with that, you go to fire one, and then you could test for fire two. Fire two, basically, you can drive now is what they're doing. You drive and pump and those kind of trainings. So down at that department, you had to take the training before your move. So you take the training, you take the test, and then you graduate to that next level. Something that's always instilled in me is to do that first, to get the training first before moving to that level. So at the time, there was some talk like, oh, you should take this, you should take the master firemen, what they call them down there. And it's like, to me, it was like, I've only been here a couple of years. I'm not that experienced in actual fires yet. I don't want to be telling people what to do. But basically, a master fireman is a somebody who filled in for the officer if they were off. So moved up here, I get off probation. I start learning my job and trying to get deeper into it, right? So I take the fire officer one class. I become a what we call OICs here. They're basically officers in charge when they're out of class. So I'm still a fireman, still designated as a fireman. But if an officer is off for my shift, I would fill in for that officer. So I did that for actually a very long time. And just because of there was no officers leaving, there wasn't any promotions, or I wasn't eligible because with this current department, you have to be here for 5 years. And a lot of it was just because of how much industry we have. You really have to get to know that before you start jumping into an officer role, so you don't get yourself in trouble or your crew. So learning that, going through the officer classes, and really kind of learning from everybody else, my officers at the time, that was stuff that kind of led my path to where I'm at. But I was a OIC for at least 5, 6 years, I believe, and then I took my promotional, got promoted up to captain, and then, yeah, working, still going to work my way up if I can.
Okay. And I'm sure through your years of service, you've seen the different type of leaders that some would say, like, you see the good and bad in both good leaders and bad leaders. So upon getting that captain's position, what did you tell yourself? Like, what kind of leader do I want to be?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And leadership in the fire service is, I don't want to say it's a mess, but we'll just say it's a hodgepodge. You can get those who are just driven by authority. They just want the authority, they want the power. And yes, we all like, well, there's no power. You're under union, you're protected. It's like, no, they want that ability that they have over someone. They want to be over you, and they want to be able to have that authority to tell you what to do, and that's what they drive on. To me, it's not that way. I'm more the transformational leadership type person. I want buy-in. I want you to tell me if it's something that it didn't come out well. Let me know. Let me know. Hey, Maybe you should word this better. I'm looking for buy-in. I'm not looking for to be your president or anything. This is an authoritarian. I'm purely like democratic. When we get on fire scenes and we need to be authoritarian, they'll know, hey, this is what I want you to do. You want to question it? Let's question it after. I'll tell you why. I always tell my guys that if there's anything that you don't agree with what I ask you to do, come talk to me. And if I can't justify it, we'll fix it, because everything has to be justified. You know how reporting works and how the legal system works. It's like, if there's not a reason why we're doing what we're doing, we need to talk about it. We need to figure out a better way. So for me, that's how I like the buy-in. I like people to understand what they're doing. I want them to learn what they're doing, not just, why are you doing that? Well, because he told me to. And you don't learn that way. It's just, I want you to learn the process. What's the process? Why are we doing it this way? You want to know it? Come ask me. I'll tell you.
The answer. Okay. This is kind of a newer question that I'm just going to start asking the guests. So, what's your definition of professionalism?
Professionalism. So that's a good question. To me, professionalism is being professional, and acting that out, because a lot of people say, oh, I'm a professional, because they're in a professional, they're getting paid to do what they're doing, right? But I even had a hard time believing. Okay, just real quick, I'm going to do a side note on you. I'm also was a coach for a long time for soccer. Okay, so I taught coaching through this high school program, middle school, high school, and basically club style soccer. All right. And learning that process really taught me a lot about how to be a leader too. And so the reason I'm side noting this a little bit is, everybody was like, oh, you're a professional coach now, you're getting paid for it. And I'm like, I am far from professional. Still kind of learning how to coach. So applying that to our jobs in the fire service, it's like, yes, you're a professional fireman. Okay. So just because I get paid makes me a professional. But how many people do we work with where we're like, this person is not a professional. They do not act professional. Not just, oh, the EMS call, you go and you take care of you're real nice to the patients. That's being professional in the community. Sure. I think everybody has that expectation. But are you professional in the firehouse? Are you professional when nobody's around, when the chief's gone for the day? Are you still professional, or are you goofing off the whole time and saying inappropriate comments and everything? So to me, it's like, you have to be professional all the time if you want to be a professional, true professional. Yes, you can have fun, sure, but what's fun? Is it fun to demean everybody? That's not real professional. Is it fun to have them poke fun and make sure they understand that, hey, we're just joking. Okay, this is just all in fun. That's all fun. That's good. That's fire service. That's, we all pick on each other, which is great. But knowing the difference between professionalism and messing around or hurting someone or being authoritarian, that's a big difference there.
Definitely. Yes. Okay. And with that being said, leadership, hot topic, big buzzword, but at least I can say through my experience since I've started this podcast and talking to many individuals with in between conferences and doing interviews, leadership seems to be a struggle in a lot of departments. Okay. It's very few far and in between do I talk to an individual that's like, my fire chief is all about outside training, remembers why we're here, fires comes first and th things of that nature. So what does leadership mean to you?
Yeah, leadership is, it truly is the cornerstone of the fire service, because with poor leadership, you're gonna have poor departments, you're gonna have poor responses, you're gonna have a lot of issues. But with great leadership, everything changes. Everything's better. Can be better, we'll say. I can't say it's always better, but it can be. Leadership starts at the company officer level. Everybody knows you're never supposed to walk past a problem that you can fix. But how many times does that happen? How many times do we
Exactly.
always walk past issues and then oh well, I can't deal with that. Oh, I can't fix that. Oh, it's just him being him, you know. And it's like, is it, or is it just nobody has talked to him? Nobody has done anything about it. So here's an interesting one for you. So I took a Fire Officer 3 class at a local training institution around here, and said leadership was like the Supreme Court has determined what pornography is. He said, you'll know it if you see it. And that's what leadership is. You'll know it if you see it. And it was like, that's a very interesting perspective on leadership. You know it if you see it. So everybody knows when they have a great leader, and everybody knows when they have a bad leader, you know, but can they put their finger on exactly what it is? Exactly why is it? Are you born with it? Is it something that you learn over time? You know, one of my senior firemen at the time said it has to do with birth order. And I'm like, oh, really? I'm the youngest out of four. So I'm not supposed to be the leader. The oldest is supposed to be the leader, right? But yeah, it's leadership's very interesting dynamic in the fire service because, like I said, it can make or break you. It's the cornerstone of your department. If you have, you can have great chief leadership. You can have great shift leadership and still have a messed up department. Because what's your administrative leadership? You know, how's that looking? Are they micromanagers? You know, with micromanagers, they completely destroy the autonomy of the department. You know, I can't do my job without somebody sitting here telling me I should do something else or I should do it differently. And they're not even trained to be firemen, you know? So, one of our previous chiefs, we'll say, was a big micromanager. And I think he didn't do it on a basis that was supposed to be derogatory or demeaning to anyone, but that's just how he ran. He wanted everything to be done perfect in his way. And it's like, there's always more than one way to do this,
Absolutely.
you know? And so, yeah, leadership is it's tough. It's a hard one to really find people that who are going to be good leaders because is well, ask you, smartest person in your department, your best leader?
Nope.
Nope. You know, and
Nope.
it's like it's so you don't even have to be smart to be a good leader. You know, you don't have to be educated to be a good leader. You know, can you teach it? Can you teach leadership? You know, I think there are qualities that people can learn, but man, we've been teaching people how to be medics for how long, and we still can't figure that out. We're still giving the wrong drug dosages, and we're still trying to figure out what to give somebody at 3 a.m. when you wake up and you're like, what are we doing again? So, yeah, leadership's a tough one, and I told you before this, I had to do a essay on my on leadership in the fire service, and it was tough to write. I ended up getting, you know, 7 pages put together of leadership, but it's like there's just so many styles of leadership and so many different programs that it's like that doesn't make you a great leader as much as going to the mechanic makes you a car, or going to, you know, the garage makes you a vehicle. Like, just because you're there doesn't mean you're going to be a good leader. You know, it's a tough one to really determine because it's a personal choice that everybody has to make. You know, if you're a problem solver, you'll probably be a really good leader in the department, in the fire service in general. And it could be all public safety. It could be, you know, in the police side as well. We need problem solvers because what do? You go to a scene, there's a problem. You know what the problem is? It's it. You know, maybe their house on fire. Maybe somebody broke their light. How do we solve the problem? You know, we can't always fix everything, but how do we solve the problem that's in front of us? And you know, those people are going to be pretty good in this job because you need problem solvers. You need thinkers. You need people who are going to think and not just, I need my SOP to tell me what I need to do. You know, how many people do you see like that? Well, what does the SOP say? It's like, can we really kind of decide this on our own without looking? You should know the general idea. The SOPs, SOGs, that's your framework of what you're supposed to do. It's not supposed to answer every single question for you, every single problem. You have to be able to solve these problems. So it's tough. Leadership is It's an interesting dynamic in the fire service because you can get some great leaders. You can get some great people who want to be great leaders who just never make it because of promotionals or because of the way the testing process is. In my opinion, that's a broken system as well. There's so much to entry-level fire service stuff that everybody's, talks about, and they've changed that how many times? CPAT used to be a big thing and now it's not. Firefighter mile we hear now is supposed to be the thing, and some departments still do a version of CPAT. It's like, if CPAT stopped, how can we still do a version of CPAT? So it's strange when it comes to leadership and trying to find the right people, but our promotional process is case in point of why we don't promote the right people.
No, that's 100% facts. And I'll start with, when it comes to leadership, to me, you are not born with it. I believe true leadership means you have found, everything comes back to your history or your, I'm trying to figure out the word. Not, you can say history, but how you're taught. So to me, if I was coming up and you were my captain, and this is just an example, let's just say you weren't the greatest captain. You weren't the greatest person to be in that role. Like, you kind of winged on certain things. You kind of didn't do things the right way. If that's all I see when I become a captain, I'm going to do the same thing. Like, you emulate what you see. You emulate your history. So I truly believe what leadership is you find a person that truly cares about the job, that has to have that passion, like you said. To me, if you don't have the passion, then yeah, you might be okay, but looking at the fire service today, if you look at all the great past leaders that we've had, they all have that flame, and they consistently kept that flame throughout their entire career. They never once forgot about the men and women on the floor. They never once forgot about the mission. It's always people first. Their priorities are fire. You know as well as I do, the fire service, man, this day and age, we are saying yes to everything. Oh, you need this done? Fire department this, fire, yes, we'll do this, we'll do that. Like, there's a point where we have to say no. Like, you just have to do it. You can't, the whole jack of all trade things, I get it to an extent, but when you say yes and you become the jack of all trades, something in your Rolodex is going to get neglected. Most of the time, it's fire. Like, EMS goes up over fire. Like, our EMS skills should be good. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be, but like, we got to find that fine balance between the EMS and fire side. Letting hazmat be the thing or rescue being like the top, you're failing. You're failing the people that are out there. So I'm with you on it. When it comes to the testing process, I think that there could be a whole lot better ways we could do it. When it comes to education, don't get me wrong, your fire chief or the person that's in charge of the organization should have some sort of educational requirement. 2-year degree, 4-year degree, bachelor, whatever you want to call it. Okay, cool. Yeah, they should know about budgets and line items and whatever goes up there, because I'm not anywhere near that, so I have no idea how that goes. But we what we'll do is, all right, well, we're gonna give you a test, okay? Instead of like going through a Jones and Bartlett or whatever these books that are out there now, and we're asking like weird questions about like, if you were to park your apparatus, how far does your apparatus need to be from the building in case of collapse? Like, I get it, but to me, that's something that's like, you should be taught that when you're being taught how to drive. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like we should change the test where it applies to real world situations. And then on top of that, I believe who better than to ask than the individuals that you work with? Find those people that you work with, because they're going to tell you the truth. Most of the time, the people are going to tell you, would you want this person as your leader? Who better than they? They get to see you at work. They get to see how you communicate, how you talk, how you treat others. Like, to me, that would be a better way of going, okay, instead of like always relying on a numbered score. Because there are some really good individuals out there who are just bad test takers. And yes, you can prep things. There's many companies that'll come in and help, but like instead of just relying on a graded score, because I know so many individuals who have done nothing throughout their career. They apply for a lieutenant's or a captain's exam, and all of a sudden they're in it for that week or month that they're studying. And then once they, if they're successful and they get it, they go back to who they were. Like that's not doing anybody any service. And then I'll play devil's advocate. Then you'll hear, well, if you, me, like if they were talking to me, if you have a problem, you're very vocal about it. Why don't you take the test? Well, it's because I may not agree with the current leadership that we have. Like I, for me, like I may not feel like they have our best interest, that they have my back, that if I go against a policy because I deemed like, hey, this is what's right, they might not have my back and my job's on the line, So I get why some really good firemen out there don't want to go into that leadership role because if you don't have the support, then why put myself in that situation?
Absolutely. And there's so much to that to unfold. Like, one, the future of the fire service, how you started out talking with where we take on so much. What's the future going to hold? The fire department always tries to be relevant. It always wants to be relevant, always wants to be called, always wants to boost numbers without, burning people's houses down or pushing people over and getting them hurt. So, how do we be more relevant? What do we do to get more funding? How many jobs do you see prevent doing their job? Like, not everybody wants it more. Cybersecurity, there's always cyber stuff going on. They're always going to have more and more and more stuff out there that's confusing people and causing cyber issues. We're out there preventing our own job. We're changing building codes. We're getting new fire codes to prevent people from getting hurt or getting out easier or being alerted of getting out. So we don't have as much to do. And now it's like fire service is going to go, okay, well, we still have to be relevant. What do we need to do? And, like you said, do you take on more? What more can we take on? You look at our small departments like mine, I have to have guys know rescue techniques, tanker techniques, ladder techniques. They have to know EMS stuff because that's all they're going to want to do. Is EMS stuff. Well, that's all we do. It's like, well, we still have to be engine people. We still have to vent. We still have to do all this. VES, you got to go in there and rescue. Like, are you prepared for everything? And it really begs the question that is the small town fire service going to be relevant anymore? Is the future going to be large departments? When it comes to the employee sides, it's always better in larger departments because you have a lot more people to take care of. But you have a lot more ability and flexibility to take care of them versus small departments. They see, oh, well, these people are taking off. We need to take their time away because they're creating overtime and budgetary issues. And it's like, no, they need to be off. You need to allow that work-life balance. And small departments don't want to do it because it's too taxing on them. But if it was a bigger, more people paying, would it be a little more, would you have that freedom, So there's so much to it, and like your the podcast that you did with my wife and the ladies, and how you saw how Columbus Fire has so many options, within their group versus a small town that's like, oh no, we can't do that, or we don't like to take time off because it causes issues with other people versus a place where there's, let's just say, 1,600 firemen. There's a lot of people to go around, a lot of people to pick up overtime for the day or whatever. So it just makes you wonder if small towns become more districts and bigger districts because it's just, one, it takes care of your people better. Two, it's more relevant with taxes because you got a lot more people paying rather than the small amount. And you got a lot more call volume going around because, you can now justify it a little better. So it's huge thing to see what the future of that is, and then back to the leadership part is testing. You kind of see the evolution of how promotionals go. You see testing, and like you said, Some people aren't test takers. And then the argument to that was always, well, no, they're just not preparing themselves. And it's like, well, what do you mean they're not preparing themselves well enough? Well, if they really wanted to prepare, they would know this. And it's like, okay, I see what you're saying, but that's not always the case because people have test anxiety. You have a lot of things going on in people's lives that you don't know about that is now starting to pull their brain, you know? So yeah, there is so much to that. So then it's like, well, how do we find the right people? You know, like we talked about, how do you find the right leader? Who's a leader in this? You know, I almost wonder, do you have to go to more of the psychological standpoint? And I'm not talking everybody fills out a survey and you send it in to a psychologist and she picks out who the leader is. I mean, truly talking to someone and that person decides who are your leaders and who are not. That's it. Not who's going to be promoted and who's not, but who are your true leaders and who's the false leaders in here? Who's the ones who are faking it? You know, just to get, you always hear, well, this guy got promoted because they wanted to get off this truck or they wanted to get away from this truck or this station. So that's why they took promotion. That's not why you take a promotion. You take the
Exactly.
promotion to lead, you know. But I think case in point, after doing this research, and I'm not going to be a scholarly person when it comes to what we should do or don't, but this is just my opinion. Like you just said, that peer review process has to be a part of it. One, why do we do evaluations if they're never considered in promotional and finding that leader? You know, two, who knows more than the people that they work with about this person? Are they lazy? Do they just sit around and are they complaining about every call they get? Oh, I got to take a medical call again. And it's like, it's kind of why we're here, I thought. Like, why are we complaining about it? So there's so much to that peer review process that it's like, ask the shifts, find out who your best candidate is. You know, that now you've also seen, I guess, part of that evolution part I was talking about was these assessment companies coming in and they put you through this assessment. And it's like, okay, what's your credibility? First off, oh, I'm the fire chief over at this department. Okay, how'd that go for you? Just because you're a fire chief doesn't make you credible to be someone who dictates who gets to be the next officer in a completely different department. You know, if you destroyed your own department, like what kind of credibility do you have? But you were a fire chief, so somehow you have that. I don't understand. So assessment center. So you bring up the assessment center and it's like, okay, here's your scenarios and go. You know, that's not always great either because as a problem solver, you want to solve the problem dynamically, not something that you're staring at a screen and trying to figure out quickly. You can't look at it for a long period of time. You get, you know, here's your quick pictures, here's your quick photos, your 360, now go. Oh, you missed this in your 360, you missed this, you missed this, you missed this. And it's like, how am I supposed to see that? I'm not even walking. I'm just sitting in a chair, you know? So a lot of people get out, that dynamicity just gets bigger and they get to see everything and they like to, you know, they're going to take notes to different things versus a photo. They're not going to take notes to that. It's just a photo. So, yeah, so there's processes to that part that it's like those assessment centers are coming up, do the acting. And then, you know, do you like the acting or do you like, you know, just the scenario? Here's a piece of paper and this is what's going on. And it's like, well, last I checked, we weren't actors, we're firemen, you know, but I could see some realism to that. So I could see how it kind of makes sense a little bit. But if you're an outside person, how do you know what they're used to doing? So
Exactly.
just for example's sake, our chief, previous chief, took care of everything. It was always, well, let me know about this. Let me have the number. Let me deal with this. And he would take care of it. So then you come in, and if you have an assessment center and somebody's trying to test you on something that you've never done, how are you supposed to know the right answer to that? How are you supposed to be prepared for it if the previous chief was your micromanager who wanted to do it all? You know, that way he can do it his certain way. So you don't really know what they're capable of and what they know and don't know because you're sitting them in front of a picture screen and trying to get these photos to say, yeah, this is your 360. Did you pick up on this? Did you pick up on this? Did you do this right? Did you move this right? You know, I don't even know your capabilities of your department. You know, just for example, was we recently had one, and it was like a commercial style fire. And in our policies, it says that for commercial fires, you need a 2.5. But we just made changes to our 1 3/4 lines to where we have 185 gallons per minute for our lines. And if you pull two off, you're going to, beat your 2.5. So it's like, and they're going to go interior with it. So taking your 2.5 interior, I know everybody, used to do it. And I know it's the big thing right now with the debate of that, but I don't have the manpower to be pushing a 2.5 through a house or through this commercial building and replace them. They can't be replaced that quick. I don't have them. I don't have the guys. So it's very interesting when it comes to trying to find that leader that you need that's going to take your department to that next level, because the process that we get there is just it's a mess. It does not find the right people.
And I'll say with you mentioned the 2.5, especially with your situation with your department and your organization, to have a chief go, I want two people to pull this 2.5 through this structure and get to that fire. That right there lets me know that that fire chief's been disengaged from the fire service for a while, because that's taxing. If you're only having, because there are some departments that operate 2 to 3 guys, like that is their manpower pool. And for you to sit back, whether that chief is in the car or sitting outside, not helping a hand, that lets me know everything I need to know about that chief. You know what I mean? Like, that's not easy. That's very taxing on the individual to have to do that. So with the advancement with technology, with hose, with nozzles, you can make a good push with 1 3/4. It's very maneuverable. It all depends, situational dependent. I understand, people are going to go, well, how involved is the structure? Of course, use common sense out there. But like you said, I mean, I 100% agree with you. And I'm going to take it back to the smaller townships. This is what I feel like is going to happen. We are in an age now where the consumer, meaning the consumer being the taxpayer, they don't want to have to spend any more money on taxes than they have to. Okay, they say that now, but until it's their house that's on fire, their family or friends that's involved, that's when that'll change. What I see happening with smaller townships that might not have the budget to send their individuals to outside training, things of that nature. Like, if you have a group of motivated firefighters that enter these departments that are not getting what they're going to need, they will eventually leave your department. They will try to find another organization that gives them what they need, whether it's bigger or smaller, whatever the case may be. I truly believe that the smaller departments will suffer because their pay is decent, but hey, if this department just down the road is going to pay this much, I'm going to go there. Like, there are departments that are competing with each other in pay. It's like, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. You've heard that, and it's, I mean, unfortunately, it is what it is with inflation and everything else that you stated. But I think these smaller communities, these smaller areas, if they can't figure out what they can do to keep their members, then eventually you'll have members within that organization that'll just know what they know, meaning they are going to just kind of be there. Yeah, we're here. We don't really want any calls. We don't really want to put in the work until it happens. Then it's like, ooh, like, oh, this is what's going on. It's happening. I'm sure you've heard of Wakeman, Ohio. That fire, or yeah, that is in Ohio, isn't it? No.
Which one? Which
Wait,
one?
the Wakeman fire.
Wait, not
Pretty
sure.
sure. Yeah, it's a hot topic. I gotta look at that. Maybe it might not be Ohio. I get a lot of my I read so many different things. But anyways, what I'm trying to say is there are a lot more smaller townships and organizations than bigger ones, but the smaller ones will have to figure something out, because if not, then yes, they will probably get eaten up by bigger jurisdictions that'll come in and provide the service, or you're going to have the members that really want to be there that are not being fulfilled seeking employment elsewhere.
Absolutely. And, I don't know if it's in your area or not, but we have this lateral transfer system in the fire service in Ohio. And basically, you don't keep your seniority or anything, but you start anywhere else at your level of pay and vacation accrual and all that, that they are topped out, or whatever you put in at one department, you can get it out of the next. So for me, it's been 17 years at my department. If I wanted to go to another department, I would be topped out fireman, topped out vacation with them as well. My seniority still starts over at zero, but our pension is all the same. So it stays, which is good. But it is nice to have. However, like you said, you're taking one issue and creating another issue with it in a way. Are people trying to do that on purpose? No, but I also think that in a way it's a good thing because the fire service will finally start being a business that it needs to be. It needs to take care of its people. It needs to be competitive. I know I can't p compete with what people make in big cities, but we have to be competitive. So you don't match them, just be competitive. Because if I were to say, if you take that job there, you make this amount of money. Let's just say it's $20,000 more than what you make now, okay? But you have to make that commute unless you want to move there. And then if you move there, your cost of living is going to go up. So let's say you make the commute. Well, that's going to be $20,000 depending on where you're going in that commute because you got wear and tear, you got fuel, you got tires, you got to get a vehicle that's going to be conducive for that travel. So it's like you do have the advantage, but if you're not showing that you're going to be competitive, they're going to leave. People are going to leave. Everybody's getting tired of not being taken care of. They're going to get tired of either your culture, your pay, time off, whatever it's going to be, but they're going to end up leaving.
Yeah, it's either they'll leave or complacency will win, and they'll just say, you know what? Like, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, like, I can just fall in line with everybody else, do the bare minimum, and then you've lost that individual there. And it is a daily struggle. And
Yeah.
I can say it is a daily struggle for me. I'll go into work and I'll do what needs to be done. And at the end of the day, I'm not looking for a pat on the back, but when you look around and you see nobody else doing it, your hard work not being appreciated after a while, you know, it's a struggle where you're like, man, I can go lay down in my bed and nobody will say a word to me. Like, why don't I just do that? And
Yeah.
then that other notion kicks in of you're just don't fall in line, don't fall for the trap, just keep going. But eventually, something's going to give. You're right. Something's going to give to the employee where you're just going to get sick and tired of it and you'll find somewhere else to go, or you will try to find a different crew or whatever the case may be. But it is a daily struggle for sure.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to kind of see the future of how this plays out, because it's good to get this fire service to finally start being competitive against each other. But at what cost? Is it going to be the cost of the taxpayer? Is it going to be the cost of the fireman? What's going to be the cost here? And that time will tell. Time will show how that's going to play out, but we'll see.
Definitely. Okay. With that being said, what kind of realistic training do you kind of provide for your members, you know, on a shift basis?
Yeah. So as like the majority of what we do is EMS. So I try to at least get some EMS training in. Trying to go through that process it's been fun. I really enjoy the training that we get. So we bring in cars, we beat up cars, we cut them open. So we'll get those real hands-on training for MVAs and stuff. We'll have our road department come over. They'll flip the vehicle on its top. And then we'll do some tunneling and all that. When it comes to the fire side, I really stress safety and survival. We can't do live fire at all, which is it's frustrating, but I'm working on that right now with the AFG. I'm really working on that part. But if we can get through that portion, but we really need live fire. I just like I said, I'm doing the AFG grant. I'm working through this process. I'm trying to figure out when was our last working fire, first due working fire. We do a lot of mutual aid, with our full-time departments around us. When was our last working fire that was a structure? And, I go through our reporting, and right now our reporting is kind of a mess because we switched over a few different companies the past few years. And I'm like, I can't find anything since 2022. And it's like, that is awful. And we're just creating this culture of complacency because we don't have live fire training. Some of our leadership's like, well, you guys are just an EMS department who do some fire. And it's like, you need to quit talking like that because we're going to get ourselves into big trouble when you tell these junior guys that they stop thinking about fire and boom, there's your next fire. Here's your string of fires. Because we do a decent job with fires. It's just kind of dropped off over the past couple of years. And it was like, it was a nice steady number. And then now it's like gone, completely gone. Yeah, we get some vehicle fires and all that. I'm not talking about that. So I'm talking about a good working fire, room content, something like that that we can get into. And it has just disappeared. And it's scary because I don't want my guys to get, hurt in a fire because, well, when was the last time we did it? And maybe we're not quite up to it. So I try to keep them working, keep them learning. I do a lot with hose streams. I've been, with schooling and stuff, I did a project on, what's the best for us, but for the future of the fire service, what's the best attack package? What hose loads should we look into? There's all kinds of technology. Dennis LeGear, he's, pushing heavy with hose streams and water. And it's like, with the abundance of heat release rate that's going out, what are we doing to prevent that? What are we doing to combat that? We need more firepower. Our 7/8 inch 150 GPMs, it's just not enough. We need more. What can we do? And so switching up to our 15/16 185s at 50, with we got biggest thing that I learned from that whole thing was change your hose. Your hose cannot be the old hose anymore. It has to be better hose, because the technology that they have in the hose has changed the way you can, well, what you can do with your nozzle. And then you have your nozzle when it's, smooth bore versus your fog stream, combination stream, all that. And now you have the bladed pattern. And it's like, okay, there's more to learn, which is good. And we brought the salesman in, like, look, this is what it provides, this is what it does. It's an adjustable smooth bore, and it's a neat process. And let's look at it, let's play with it, let's figure it out. So yeah, going through that and learning. There's so much to the fire service and so much going on. We try to keep them up doing something, pulling hose, pulling hose, pulling hose. There's a lot of training involved for us just because of how complacent we can get for our department's call volume.
Understood. Okay. Love the message. Love the message. Recruitment and retention. What do you think the fire service can improve on or do better when it comes to that?
Okay, so recruitment and retention with the fire service is, we hit a little bit about it with the laterals. I really am a strong proponent of the fire service finally treating their people like a business, like how to take care of people, how to be competitive with other departments, because you have to do it. It's a must now. It's not something that is going to be a it's going to be something that's just going to blow past. Laterals are here to stay. They're here to stay. They're going to get bigger. Yeah, you'll never probably bring over seniority because the union issue and layoffs and all that, but they're here to stay because they're going to get tired of where they're at. Let's just say it's a not one of them situations where it's like, well, I just want a better department, grass is always greener type situation. I'm just saying, let's say you have to move. You have a family issue that I have to go take care of my elderly parent, and I need to move down here, and I can lateral to that department. So in a way, it's a good thing, but in another way, they're going to have to be competitive with their pay. They're going to have to be competitive with how they take care of their people, and it's going to force the fire service into at least paying a proper wage. Yeah, the unions did a great job with prevailing wage and everything, but this will keep departments within that close proximity of pay. It's not going to be a huge discrepancy anymore. Of well, they have a lot of money up there, they could do it. Yes, some departments don't have the resources of a lot of population to where they can get that covered by tax base. But with, EMS billing is bringing in some decent money as well, and so they're just going to have to get creative with their funding. It's going to be a process that is going to open up more things. I think, like I told you before, the districts are going to have to get bigger. That's more people paying, sharing the wealth. Yes, it's more responsibilities and it's going to be ugly because there's so many who don't want to lose power because I'm the chief, those titles. But I think it's gonna end up being it's gonna be big because you're gonna start seeing county systems. You're gonna start seeing maybe it's a city that's going to take over a lot more area. I just saw a job posting for a department in the state who was it's not a big city. And I'm like, how are they paying that much? It's not a big city at all. And I've been there. I've been there. My wife used to go to college up there, and I'm like, well, that's very interesting. And I started looking, and they cover five different townships around them. I'm like, smart move, smart, because honestly, they're just making their footprint bigger, so that's more people to pay the same amount. And now they have money that they can fund, take care of their people, get more personnel, and they're going to have a lot bigger responsibilities, a lot more calls. They want the fire service to take calls. Everything is all about how many calls do you take? How many calls do you take? On the administrative standpoint, they're looking at you going, can you justify your existence? And when you're like, oh, well, we take some calls, they're like, should you be here? So, it's very interesting to see the evolution of the fire service. How, when I first started at my job, seven guys a shift still. Okay, it hasn't changed since the 70s. But then you look back and you're like, why did they have seven guys a shift for like 600 calls a year? That's incredible. They have more people than they have calls. So it was very interesting. But now, of course, that's not the case. Now it's call volumes going crazy everywhere. I think when we're going to see this big jump, and it's coming. And what's happening is we're going to start seeing the boomers into retirement age. They're going into nursing homes. They're going to go into, assisted livings. They're going to go into senior living, and you're going to start seeing a lot more call volume. It's going to get more busy, and the call volumes is going to continue to escalate. Will it drop off after that? I don't know. Because I know when I was a kid growing up, I rode in the ambulance one time, and there's probably associated with that, but I got ran over by a tractor and snapped my femur. Okay. I was only five. So very young. We have to be dead or dying to get in the ambulance. Otherwise, you're get in the car, I'll take you to the hospital.
Right,
And that's how I treat my kids too.
right.
Like, they're sick. Oh yeah, you're sick. How sick are you? Has it been 3 days yet? Okay, I'll take you to the doctor finally. But same thing for me. Like, I always, sadly, I get I had a kidney stone. All right, they're not fun. I don't recommend them to anyone. But I'm on the floor like, ah, oh, this is miserable because you can't get comfortable. So, like my wife's like, should I call the ambulance? I said, don't, do not call the ambulance. Put me in the car, and we'll go. So we drive ourselves to the hospital and all that. So that all depends on your generation you're bringing up. I think there's a lot more people calling for a lot more less things than they used to. The acuity has kind of dropped off quite a bit. I know when I first started here, we didn't have a ton of calls, but we had a lot of really good calls because they wait too long to call 911. And so the EMS calls were pretty big, pretty big. So it's definitely not that way anymore, but it cycles around with generation to generation on how. When they call EMS, when they don't, you pay for it, use it kind of deal, or is it one of those that you're not getting in the ambulance? I will take you to the hospital. I don't care if your bone's sticking out of your arm, that kind of thing. So we'll see what the fire service gets into, and time will tell with it. But that's my best guess is it's just going to get busier. It's just going to be EMS is going to get busier, fire side as well. Just because the same aspect of that, like a lot of the memory issues and get around issues. I know, for instance, my father, he has been cooking and fell asleep, and it's like, don't do that.
Right,
He was a
right.
fireman, and it's like, you can't do that. So you're going to see issues like that. Just, human error is still going to be human error, and we're going to see some fires that way. If residential sprinkler systems become a thing, then maybe that's something that will help deter that a little bit, when at least bigger fires, keep more contained, not necessarily extinguish it all the way. But till then, we still have no ability to get into residential homes to for inspections here or for walkthroughs or anything. So it's more of a, it'll be based on them. Are they going to maintain it, and will it be maintained properly, and will it freeze up in the wintertime and burst and cause issues? And now the insurance companies are going, no, there's more burst incidents than there are fires, so just let it burn down. So I don't know. It'll be very interesting to that standpoint, because I, again, part of my studies in I'm going for my fire administration degree right now for my 4 year, my bachelor, and one of them was how they basically put a price on life. Okay, and it wasn't anything to do with the fire service, but it was, way back in the day, they put a price on life. And then today, how everything business wise and insurance, when it comes to manufacturers and all that, how they put a price on life, somebody's life. And it's kind of disgusting in a way, but it's like just one of those that, will insurance company keep up with some of the stuff that they need to do? Because will that price dictate what they're going to do? Or will it just be like, hey, it's cheaper for us to just replace your house, so let it burn down? I don't know. It'll be interesting kind of see that process.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay. Before you decide to hang it up, where would you like to see yourself retiring within the fire service?
So I've been asked this question before with some of the people I work with, and I would like to be a chief officer somewhere. And like I tell them, I've got, what do I have now? 7 years left, 8 years left. Sorry, my dog is, he's
You're
old and
fine.
he's trying to get up. So, yeah, 7, 8 years left. And if I'm still riding right front of the engine, I don't think I'd be able to go much further. I'm in good shape. By all means, I just kind of think of the future. Will I still be in good shape, in that short period of time? Will this job that take too much of a toll on me, and I won't be able to do it as well anymore? So if I'm still right front when it comes 25, do I get out? That'll be the question. If I am hitting my goal and being a chief officer somewhere, I would probably end up staying a little bit longer than 25, going into the drop, or kind of going that process, because I just think that I do have some to offer to the fire service, and I would like to do it. I would like to lead a department. Just all depends on where and when's my time.
I mean, I love your answer, and it's one of those things. As we get older, I saw a quote. It was somebody put, when it comes to like the fire service, it was something that had to deal with like, I always say that the fire service is a young man and women's game. And then the quote that somebody put was, the fire service is more like dependent on the individual and how they take care of themselves. And I get it. But reality is, as you get older, your body does not recuperate as fast as a young person. So that's why I always kind of say, like, it is a young man and women's game, because with young people, they're able to recuperate faster, they're more flexible. Now, granted, as you get older, there are things that you can do to kind of maintain your physical well-being, your flexibility, but it's father time. You're gonna have stuff that hurts more, aches, joints, things of that nature. So while I 100% agree with you that as we get older, you should, physical fitness actually to me is should become more important, because it's just, you will wake up and you're like, I never used to hurt like this, like I'm hurting now. And with equipment you would think with 2024, 2025 coming up right around the corner, our equipment will become lighter. It seems like that's not the case. It's getting heavier.
Yes.
So, you know, like I agree with everything that you stated. And I love how you just put it is what it is. It all depends on what's in the cards.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure everybody would love to be whatever role that they want to be, but like if it's not in your script, as I call it, because everyone in this life, man, all of our lives, it's a script. The script's been written. We just don't know. We don't know what the outcomes are. We're just following every day is the next page, the next
Yeah.
page. So we have to see, you know, time will tell what goes down, but I love your
Absolutely.
answer. I love your answer. And
I agree. It's definitely a young man's game.
yeah, I mean,
Yeah, those night calls.
regardless, yes, I mean, that's why like
They're tough.
I agreed with the statement, but I also kind of like disagreed because like you said, I know for a fact back when I was younger, we could get a call and I can get up, go to the call, come back to the station and go right back to sleep, no problem. Now, at minimum, it's an hour before I can go back to bed. And I used to
Yes.
not have that problem. But with age comes certain issues.
Yes. And too much on your mind, and you just start
Too
thinking about things. It's
right.
like, ah.
Right. Like, you know,
Yeah.
when I was young, like, you know, my priorities were, all right, just make sure I do my job. When I got back, man, I was gone. I was knocked out again. But now it's so different. And I'm sure there's other people that can relate out there. Like, I used to not be like that. I used to be able to ride backwards on a fire truck. I can't do that now.
Get
I get
motion
motion sickness, and it's like
sickness.
I have to ride looking forward. So, you know, it's a cycle. And you know, if you're young and you're listening to this and you're laughing, I'm telling you, it's gonna happen. It's life.
Yeah. I used to when I did my internship through the high school, there was a guy there. He was younger. He was probably, I think he was like 5 years older than me. Graduated 5 years ahead of me, and he would fall asleep anywhere. And I was like, "That is incredible." He's like on the table and he's asleep. And I'm like, "Is he just messing with us?" And they're like, "No, he's asleep. That's how he is. He just falls asleep anywhere." It's like that is incredible. But yeah, I could never do that. But yeah, I'm with you now. Like when it comes to getting back to the station and laying down, it's like, well, there's an hour gone by and still, especially if it's after four, I'm in trouble. I'm not going to go back to sleep. It's
Usually I
like,
don't. Yes.
just might as well get up.
Definitely. Definitely. I appreciate the conversation, man. I really, what I like about talking to individuals that have your circumstances, you're having to do more with less. You know, you have to be a jack of all trades. One thing that you mentioned earlier, I 100% agree with you. Chief officers that yes, your fires are down within your respective organizations, but don't say, hey, we are an EMS-based department. That right there, like you said earlier, that complacency will settle into the minds of the young ones and be like, hey, you know, he's right. Like, we haven't ran a fire in so long. I can kind of be lackadaisical on this. And that right there is where people get hurt, potentially killed.
Absolutely right. And that's definitely something it's always killed me. It's just like, let's not talk about that. Let's not say that. Because I'm like, we're due, right? So that's why I always tell, we're due. It's coming. We're gonna get a big string, and you watch, it's going to be a whole week of fires or something. It's gonna get crazy. But let's not say that, oh, we're, you know, all you're doing is EMS calls, it's not a big deal. And it's coming. It's coming.
Definitely,
I'm
definitely.
like, it's either going to be a big fire or it's going to be a lot of fires. I'm like, but it's coming. It's going to cycle through.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. Everybody goes through that cycle. You go through a cycle of, man, we've slept all night.
Yeah.
I know shifts have been, hey, we didn't get up at all. And it's like, oh, that's great. But the next shift's like, we get up like two or three times every night. It's in a circle, and your time on your shift, your apparatus, your department is coming. I love the message, Mike.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you accepting the invite, coming on Talking Shop. I really do appreciate people like you. Keep fighting the good fight. I know it's hard, especially for smaller organizations having to do more with less. I mean, you just stated earlier, or way earlier into the interview, one person's allowed off for vacation. That's a lot. That is a lot to deal with. I can't imagine that. So yeah, and the crazy thing is there are a lot more departments that have to deal with that than the ones that are like, oh man, I can take off whenever I want. Like we have that candidacy pool where we can do that.
Yeah, I could tell you our overtime list. So we have a running overtime list, and you probably, if you know the answer to the overtime list, like let me know because I'm still waiting for the answer to the overtime list. But so we have a running list, and it's hours that were offered to that person. Okay, so think of that. You have a list of 21 guys, and you're at 1,150 hours. Okay, so that's a lot of overtime. I'm not saying there was 1,150 hours of overtime because if I was the first one offered, I took it. All right. So I'm just saying that within that page, everybody's in the 1150 range. So there's a ton of overtime on our department because of that. And it's pretty tough because administration's like, well, we could drop you down to five minimum. And we're like, no, we can't do that. We can't reduce. We're like, so let's add a guy. And they're like, no, we're not going to add a person. And say, we haven't added anybody since the 70s. I think it'd be a great time. And they're like, no, we're not going to add people, but we'll take it away from you. And it's like, no, that'll just make us have to work harder. So and you'll never get it back. You know that. Yeah, it's not, though, you'll have to fight forever to get that back in there. And so it makes it very difficult kind of playing that.
Definitely, man. Well, like I said, keep fighting the good fight, Mike, and I truly appreciate you coming on Talking Shop.
Hey, appreciate you. Thanks for the invite.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.